Welcome, my name is Will Cooling and you're listening to the It Could Be Said podcast. I am joined by the one, the only, Dr. Luke Middubs. Say hello to everybody, Luke.
Hello, everybody.
And in this, the difficult second album of our podcast, we are talking about the opening few days of the general election campaign, which have been dominated by what a strange coincidence, which is both sides desperately trying to convince the public that somehow Jeremy Corbyn could become Prime Minister. How well are they doing, Luke?
Well, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn kicked off his campaign the other day with a perfectly good opening speech of a general election, which I think we're going to talk about a little later on, and Theresa May is doing a good impression of the Duchess of Kent. So, pretty well, actually.
Well, it is one of the remarkable ones. Let's talk about that Corbyn speech. It was being delivered in Birmingham on Thursday. Coincidentally, that is one of the areas where in May there's going to be mayoral elections. This is clearly a local elections pit stop that they converted into a general election set piece. And what was he talking about, Luke? Was it something to do about the establishment and a rigged system and the people against the powerful? Would it be something like that?
Well, I think you just summed it up quite well in a sentence. It was clear that Jeremy Corbyn was channeling a little bit of vote leave. He wouldn't thank me for saying it, but I think he was channeling a little bit of Donald Trump. It was very much, we're the underdogs in this election. We're on the side of ordinary people. He may even have said ordinary working people at one point. And the idea was that the Conservative Party are on the side of vested interests and big business. One of the things that really struck me about that speech was how clear and open he was on how redistributive Labour plans to be, how much he plans to tax the rich and give to the poor. Now, Labour governments under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown did that in policy terms, but rhetorically, they were quite careful to avoid it.
Well, I mean, yes, I mean, there's a famous story of Gordon Brown talking to some Labour MPs and policy wonks. And they were talking about the impact that the tax credits has had on alleviating poverty. And they were like, well, this is great. This is redistribution in action. And Brown was like, yes, but we can never tell anybody. So it's, of course, this idea that Labour didn't do redistribution, this myth of how New Labour was these centre-right caricatures, Tony Blair's just a Tory, actually contributed to Jeremy Corbyn eventually becoming leader of the Labour Party.
Mm.
And what I was struck by, you mentioned vote leave, is every now and again, Jeremy Corbyn's fundamental Euroscepticism comes shining through. When he was going on a big riff about how he won't listen to the people in Westminster, he just slipped in Brussels for no reason. It had nothing to do with his speech. He just couldn't help himself having a good pop at the bureaucrats in Brussels. So I enjoyed that. One of the interesting things I don't know about you Luke, is that Corbyn in the set piece speeches, he really does come across as a very different type of politician. And this is going to be the first election, you know, in living memory, you'd have to go back to probably to 64, where neither of the major candidates had played a key role in the general election beforehand. Even elections such as 2010, 1979, when both parties had new leaders, the leaders had actually been involved at quite a high level in previous campaigns. So, say, Gordon Brown had basically co-led the Labour campaign in 2005. Margaret Thatcher and Jim Callaghan had both been quite active in the 74 election, despite not being party leaders. But Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May, this is all new to them. They haven't been prominent people in past election campaigns.
No, and I mean, Jeremy Corbyn was as backbench as you got. I mean, I think another interesting thing about the speech was, and something I'm going to be very interested to see in the next few days, is the rhetoric in that speech going to be matched by the manifesto? Because I suspect the manifesto is going to be a lot less radical in its policy commitments than that speech would suggest. And if that is the case, Corbyn runs a risk of being caught by the media in a gap between rhetoric and policy.
One of the interesting things is obviously one of the problems that all the political parties have is they've had no notice. I mean, this is the first time since 1974 that we weren't expecting a general election at some point this year. So this is the first time you had a truly snap election. And they've just not got the manifestos ready. These usually take months of preparation to get them ready. And so Labour's already talking about how there may be a rolling manifesto rather than dumping it all at the start of the campaign at the beginning of May. I don't think the issue of the policies falling short of his rhetoric is an issue, because everyone knows he's an unreconstructed Benite. So he doesn't need to convince people he is one. And the other thing as well is even if it's just the policies they've already announced, they're quite radical in their way. Promising to borrow £500 billion for a public works programme, that is incredible. I mean, that would be radical in America. Think about how much bigger the American economy is compared to ours.
Is that actually Labour Party policy, or was it just something he pulled out of his head to beat Owen Smith, though?
Good point. Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, can you point to a Labour Party policy document that contains that?
Yeah, okay, that's a fair point. They may shy away from putting it in the manifesto, which would be a mistake, because the Tories will come and attack you on it, so you might as well try and sell the positives, the positive side of the policy. I thought Corbyn's speech was good. It was impassioned. He does have the one problem is he's not used to talking for TV. It's been 2 years, he's gotten better. He's still not good, because one thing is, if you're talking in public, it's a difference between theatre acting and acting for the screen. In the theatre, you naturally speak louder, you naturally exaggerate your movements, because you're trying to convey something to the plebs and the cheap seats. When you're trying to talk on TV, you don't shout, and Corbyn can't help himself, but he also can't help himself remembering midway through he's not meant to shout. So all Corbyn's speeches have shouting. He remembers he's not meant to shout, and then he whispers the next section of his speech until he starts shouting again. So
I did think one of the interesting we've got to bear in mind that was an invited audience. So We got to discount the quite positive reaction it got. It's not as though he was speaking to the general public. But what I did think was interesting, and something that's not been all that characteristic of Jeremy Corbyn, was his willingness to engage with the press. And I think that's in very marked contrast to Theresa May, who, as I said in my opening sort of remarks, seems to be conducting this election by keeping the press as far away from her as she possibly can. And I just wondered what you've got to say about that. Well,
it was one of these things where, to be honest, the reason politicians keep the ordinary people and the press as far as possible is because ordinary people and the press can be a bit embarrassing and put them on the spot. I think there's a fantastic story in the 2015 election where, so one of the things you used to get in British elections was the politicians do press conferences in the morning. So you'd have your Labour press conference, your Tory press conference, your Lib Dem press conference, and sometimes the leaders would go, but often it'd be senior politicians who would answer questions on the record. And so the major parties all thought, well, rather than we all rent space for these press conferences, why don't we come together and rent a space for these press conferences? And they got through all the negotiations, and I'm going to rent this place. And then they were like, well, we're not actually planning to do any of these press conferences this time round, are you? And so quickly it was like, oh no, actually, we all want to keep the press as far away as possible from the politicians. Because the reality is what TV needs, what newspapers really need, is cool photos and video clips. The Nick Robinson asking a tough question is nice, but what they actually need is just the shots of the politicians. The politicians realise that they can keep the press away, avoid embarrassing confrontations, and still give the media what they actually need.
See, I disagree with you. I think that's true up until a point, but I think if you try and do that for 7 weeks, the broadcast media in particular are going to get very, very hacked off at you. And Gordon Brown tried to do this in 2010, and it didn't work as a strategy. He was roundly criticised for it. And I think one of the reasons the Gillian Duffy incident got as much play as it did was that Brown had run such a soporifically boring campaign up to that point that the press were just willing to jump on anything interesting that he did. Also, I think the general public at some point want their politicians to behave as they expect politicians to behave. We're not auditioning for a Duchess of Kent. We're not auditioning for minor royalty. We want our politicians to be put on the spot and ask difficult questions. And their ability to answer them, you know, ultimately is what we're supposed to be judging this election on. Now, I don't think it'll hurt Theresa May too badly initially, simply because so much of the print media supports the Conservative Party in this election. But I think increasingly, the broadcasters, particularly those with Rolling News, the BBC and the Sky, are going to get very hacked off if all they're getting constantly is B-roll, is like you say, pictures. At some point, they're going to want an event. And if Theresa May doesn't create one, they'll create one for her. She'll have her Gillian Duffy moment.
Well, I mean, to be fair to Theresa May, she has done a Q&A today, but again, it's quite carefully controlled audience. So I think they realise they can't just have a go around and shake hands, but they realise they can also give the appearance of Q&As, of her answering questions on her feet, without actually risking a bad event. Because what you forget is that, you know, Gillian Duffy happens because they let Gordon Brown out into the wild and he actually confronted somebody real. And actually, to be fair, well, everybody forgets about Gillian Duffy, which for those who have forgotten, was Gordon Brown was going around, I think it was Rochdale, wasn't it?
It was going around Rochdale,
bumped into an old woman who was a lifelong Labour voter. She started complaining about there being too many immigrants coming into the area. And Gordon Brown kind of explains his policy and actually did very well. It's very difficult when you're a politician in these situations. There's a famous one with Tony Blair and a woman called Sharon Stoker in 2001, where she berated him over hospital cuts. And he basically just kind of stood there, went pale and just said, I'm sorry. Whereas Gordon Brown actually did a good job of explaining the government's policy and not quite talking around. But I mean, she left that conversation saying, I'm going to vote Labour. Unfortunately, he left his mic on and he said she was some bigoted old woman. And kind of, you could almost see him shudder at the thought of getting that close to a real person for a change. So I think you can't overestimate the difference of Brown's position and Theresa May's. Everyone knew Gordon Brown was going to lose. Most people expected the Tories to get an outright majority. So he was yesterday's man. So the media could be a lot tougher with him. Theresa May, everyone expects to be re-elected. You know, likes of the BBC, ITV, Channel 4, Sky, they won't want to push it too far with the government, particularly a government led by somebody with a vindictive streak a mile long. So I think it should be fine. And you mentioned the printed press. You can't overestimate how far in the tank the Tory press is for the Tory party. So like, take the Mail on Sunday. They literally took out of circulation their star columnist, Peter Hitchens, for 2 weeks. Because although he's Conservative, he's anti-Tory and was going to write anti-Cameron articles.
This was in 2015.
So, you know, I think May will be fine. I mean, you're right, you have to give the press a story. But there are ways to do that in very controlled environments. And it is a shame. I mean, you compare us to America, where you have politicians talking in genuine rallies with actual people. You know, we in this country we create the impression of that. It's all done by camera trickery, where it's like you have 30 people behind the politician whilst the politician's talking, and that's it. That's the entire event. So it's a shame we don't have more active participation. But I just think that's where we are. Talking of Theresa May, interesting policy developments. We're talking about what Labour's manifesto may look like. The Tories are basically in this weird process of trying to work out how far they can go in unpicking all the ridiculous things David Cameron said to get re-elected in 2015?
I mean, just to come back very briefly on the previous conversation. Yeah, I think Theresa May will win this election and that will limit what the broadcasters can do. But they can always play up the campaigns of other prominent Tories. They can always paint other Tories as the prince or princess across the water. And I think you've already seen that a little bit with some of the coverage of Ruth Davidson. But anyway, moving on to your point about policy. I mean, there are two interesting ones. There's Philip Hammond very strongly suggesting that the triple lock on pensions will be watered down, and suggesting that the Tories' pledge not to raise taxes at all will either be watered down or abandoned. Now, the triple lock thing has been trailed for some time. I think that would have happened anyway in the course of this Parliament. But the tax thing was always a somewhat stupid pledge. I mean, Amit Gill, who ran the grid for the Conservative Party, ran the schedule for the Conservative Party in the last election, said they basically came up with that pledge to fill a day to get a news story. It never made much sense in policy terms. But what's really fascinating is these are the kind of policies you only consider when you've got a 21-point lead.
Well, I mean, it's not just that as well. I mean, it is more profound than just the fact that the Tories know they can beat Jeremy Corbyn. It is interesting that the Tory party is inching ever closer to not chucking money at old people and actually start to raise taxes. Now, one thing we haven't heard of, and I really hope they do throw away, is this ridiculous increase in the personal allowance of their income tax, because it's a massive, it is a regressive, for various boring reasons which I won't get into, it's actually quite a regressive use of money, particularly when you're cutting means-tested benefits to fund. And it's really expensive. I mean, it's unbelievable the fact that when the government's imposing so much austerity on the country, they are wasting money and basically giving everybody 20 quid more in pay every year, every month. It never makes any sense. It's a really bad policy. What is interesting, you mentioned Ruth Davidson, is that she actually kept the policy from the manifesto, which is the commitment to spend 0.7% of GDP on international aid every year. And apparently Ruth Davidson was quite crucial in persuading Theresa May to not abandon that pledge. And to me, whatever you think of the merits of the policy, it's probably right to keep it for political reasons, because the Tories really don't have a lot to offer middle class liberal voters who for, say, fiscal reasons vote Tory. And I think if you'd combine the tough line on immigration, the tough line on Brexit, and removing the international aid commitment, you do start getting some of these liberal conservatives wonder whether this is a party they're comfortable with.
Yeah, I think that's true. You've also got to remember, I think, that Theresa May is a vicar's daughter. So I think the idea of putting this, presenting the 0.7 pledge in moral terms, you know, naturally has an appeal to her. I was never convinced that was the kind of thing she'd get rid of. I mean, I think what's going to be interesting is, does that get rolled into a security budget that includes things like defence funding for MI5, or is it a standalone commitment? The other rumour is that it might be 0.7% over a five-year period, so it might fluctuate over the course of a parliament. And I think, actually, that probably makes more sense in policy terms, because you're not sticking to an arbitrary figure. You can actually plan on the basis of need.
Well, also, I mean, the issue they had this year was just because they made this commitment. It's almost like the old joke about how local councils do their road building work in February, March, because they're just blowing whatever money they got left. They actually had to go and rush projects to start because they had to make sure they hit this target. I don't think they'll roll it into military spending. I think what you might get is once we leave the EU, we start making a lot of bilateral grants to Eastern European and Southern European countries. And because it's no longer tied up in our contribution to the EU, that can be counted as part of international development.
Yeah.
And it's something that Norway does. So Norway, there's such things as Norway grants, where they basically spend money in poor European countries on a nice development project. Anyway, so we've talked about Corbyn's speech, we've talked about Theresa May's attempts to escape from the legacy she got from Cameron. One of the other things that the two have been arguing about is a question of debates, because Jeremy Corbyn would quite like debates, but Theresa May is quite clear that she's not taking part in them. So the obvious first question to you, Luke, is would you like to see Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn debate each other?
To be honest, I'm somewhat agnostic on this issue, because whilst I think they do generate a certain amount of attention and they might engage people who otherwise aren't very engaged by elections, in both 2010 and to a lesser extent in 2015, they pretty much obliterated all other forms of campaigning. I think what I'd like to see is what happened in 2015, where you had David Cameron and Ed Miliband talking to a studio audience and being interviewed back to back, rather than the kind of set piece debate. I actually found that to be a more informative format.
I also liked what they did with the interviews as well. I thought the interview and the Q&A were quite good. Talk through some of the mechanics about this. It's worth mentioning that the Prime Ministerial debates are quite new. So the first time was in 2010. And that was, but they have been, the debate about having debates is kind of a long, hoary tradition of British politics. I mean, there was a big controversy in 1979 over whether there's going to be a debate between Callaghan and Thatcher. And basically what it usually boils down to is if you are the favourite, You don't want to have them, because why do an event that could reset the race? If you think you're going to win, why take the risk? If you're the incumbent, you all being equal don't want them, because the idea is having the challenger on the same platform as you makes them look more prime ministerial, makes you look less prime ministerial. It basically puts them on your level. And if you're the Tories, you don't want to move things being equal, because you will have more money for your campaign. And obviously, as we talked about, the debates tend to obliterate all other campaigning activity. It's free airtime for the Labour Party. You're basically wasting your financial advantage. So say in the 80s, because Thatcher fit all three, she was the favourite in 83 and 87, she was the incumbent, and she was a Tory, they just weren't an issue. She was never going to agree to them. You did have times with Major in 97 and also Gordon Brown in 2010 when the incumbent did want them. The weird thing was in 2010 was Cameron agreeing to them. Because on the basis that he had more money than his opponents, and on the basis that he was a favourite, he really shouldn't have agreed to them. And the reason we got them was twofold. One, his snake oil advisor, Steve Hilton, they appealed to his sense of Americana, his type of gimmick that he thought revolutionized politics. But also, Cameron, Osborne had such a low opinion of Gordon Brown that they thought they would turn up to the studio, Cameron would look brilliant like the Ken doll he is, Brown would come and look like Voldemort, and the people just flock and vote for Cameron. And that was a deeply unpopular decision within the Tory hierarchy. Famously, the deputy chairman of the Tory party in that election actually funded a lot of their key seat campaigns, Lord Ashcroft, went on BBC's election night programme and put the boot into Cameron, and what an idiotic decision it was to take part in the debates, because what the debates did was they let Nick Clegg shine, and they just stopped Cameron portray the election as a straight Tory Labour fight.
Well, Well, I'd just like to disagree with a little bit of that. I don't think you can say the entire Tory hierarchy. Certainly, Lord Ashcroft was upset, famously. But I mean, if you look, I mean, George Osborne supported that decision, as well, did Andy.
Within the Tory, I didn't say all the Tories. I just said there wasn't happy.
Okay, but I think Ashcroft was actually in a minority there. And you've got to remember the size of the electoral mountain Cameron had to climb. He had to win 114 seats. You know, a scale of challenge that no opposition party had ever been able to surmount in a single election. So I think it actually did make some sense from Cameron's point of view to do something a little bit different, because what he required was different from previous elections.
I don't know. I still think the Tories would have done better without him. And Cameron certainly grew to agree, because he tried his very best to not do them the second time. So it's worth talking about how the debates are organised in Britain. So it's not like America, where it's kind of became standardised and you have a debates commission that works with the parties and the broadcasters to get the debate structured. It's basically the parties and the broadcasters. If I was Labour, next time I'm in government, you know, sometime in 2030, I would try and change this system and give the responsibility to the Elections Commission. The parties and the broadcasters meet, they try and agree a format that's consensual. They are constrained by the role of Ofcom, the Office for Communications, because their role is to police the amount of TV time parties get during the campaign. So the way it works in Britain is Ofcom look at the strength of the parties in terms of number of seats in Parliament, in terms of current and previous polling, and other previous electoral performance, such as in local and European elections. And they come to a decision about who are the major parties, which obviously is always going to be Labour and the Tories. But then who gets this kind of not quite major, not quite minor? So traditionally Lib Dems as a third party get it. Last time UKIP and Nigel Farage's party also got it. And then in Scotland and Wales, the Nationalists get it within those particular regions. And in Northern Ireland, because they have a completely different party system, they're treated separately. So what makes this complicated is you're trying to get the parties to agree, you're trying to get a good event, and you're trying to comply with these rules. So you could make the argument for, say, a Labour-Tory debate, but then the Lib Dems would sue, saying we should be involved. You could make an argument to include the Lib Dems and UKIP, but then the Greens would complain. And the Tories might complain, because the Tories might say, well, you're including UKIP, which takes votes from us, but you're not including the Greens, which take votes from Labour. That's not fair. We won't participate. But because the Greens aren't a major party, then the Nationalists could complain that the Greens get an advantage over them that isn't warranted by their status. So it's an incredibly complicated chess game to work out.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why, even if Theresa May was more agnostic about these debates, they probably won't happen. Because it took months to negotiate the last set of debates. On the issue of designation, I think there's an outside chance. I'm not saying this lightly, but there's an outside chance that Ofcom waits until after the local elections, after it's got one more set of real data to go off. I think the broadcasters would hate them for it, because it would be really inconvenient for them. But if I'm Ofcom, because the situation is as complicated as you described it, I want as much hard electoral evidence as I could get.
I think the problem with that is the local elections occur after the short campaign's begun, so after the dissolution of Parliament. So you really wouldn't be giving the broadcasters any notice to plan their schedules. I mean, it might just be just for practical reasons. Ofcom can't make the decision in time. But I can't see how they can take the local elections too much into account. That is a crucial thing to say about designation. So the issue is, we've gone from a situation going into 2015 election, where in the previous election the Tories had got mid thirties, Labour had got 30, the Lib Dems had got 25, and everybody else had been nothing. To a situation now where the Tories got mid-30s, Labour's on 30, UKIP got 40, this is percentage of the population, UKIP got 14, Lib Dems way back on 8, SNP destroyed in Scotland. So there's now an argument that there are no UK parties that qualify for that intermediate status. Because
quite possibly, or you've either got to grant it to nobody, or you've got to grant it to all of them, frankly.
Because neither the current Lib Dems, who have 8 parliamentary seats, or UKIP, which technically have 1 based on previous election results, are the same level of status as the Lib Dems going into 2015.
No.
But the problem is, the SNP are a major party in Scotland. And not just a major party, they are the major party. So you might have a weird thing where you could safely exclude Paul Nuttall and Tim Farron, but you would have to extend an invitation to Nicola Sturgeon.
I think that's true. But I mean, I think this is all extremely hypothetical, because in the real world, these debates aren't going to happen.
No, and they're not going to happen because partly for the reason I said earlier, which is if you're a popular Tory incumbent, you don't want the debates to happen. No, it's a triple lock. There are 3 reasons why you don't want them to happen. I think the other thing as well is it's not entirely clear that Jeremy Corbyn would be as hopeless in a prime ministerial debate as some people think.
No, I mean, a big part of the reason he's leader of the Labour Party was how well he did in the debates in 2015. Because, I mean, Yvette Cooper and Andy Burnham had no idea how to handle him. What Corbyn's got, and again, I don't think he'd thank me for saying this, he shares something with Nigel Farage in that he comes across as not a politician. And he also comes across, on a personal level, as being quite a nice bloke. He sort of reminds you of your granddad or your uncle. You'd imagine he's going to offer you a toffee.
I mean, just one thing. That nice bloke thing is not just how he comes across. I mean, by all accounts, he's a genuinely nice guy, which is one of the reasons he got the nominations to actually go to the members' ballot. That there were a lot of London MPs who remembered him being quite kind and helpful when they started in politics. I think you're right. I think he looks totally different to what we expect from a politician. He's comfortable in his own skin, as long as he's not being challenged too much, which in a debate format doesn't happen. It's not like he needs to be repeatedly asked a question he thinks stupid. And he's quite good at the lighter moments. It's like that famous thing of where he's asked who Anton Deck are, and he has to go, "I don't know who Anton Deck are." It's like, that sort of stuff comes across as very authentic and endearing. And the other thing is, what it has to be said is literally fewer people believe he can become Prime Minister than think the moon landings were faked.
Yeah.
It'd almost be impossible for him to do worse than what people expect, because the expectations would be so low that he would win by default.
And also, I don't think that Theresa May would be very good at that that format. I mean, Theresa May, for all her strengths as a politician, is not good at thinking on her feet. And a debate requires you to have the ability to think on your feet.
I think she'd do better than you think, because the type of debate we'd probably get is a town hall Q&A session. It is true she's not good at thinking on her feet, but she's definitely good at preparation. And debates do reward preparation. You look at someone like Hillary Clinton, somebody who no one's ever accused of connecting with people or thinking on her feet. she did very well in debates because she's somebody who prepares to an obsessive level, and that preparation was rewarded. And I think Theresa May would do better than a lot of people in what the Americans would say in the Beltway would expect. But I understand why May doesn't want to take the chance. What we're probably going to end up with is a sort of Question Time special, where you have Theresa May, you have Corbyn. To what extent the other parties are involved is a real open question. One of the things that is easy to forget now is the broadcasters really wanted to involve UKIP because Nigel Farage's box office. With it being Paul Nuttall, there's not that same impetus from them to include them. Because the Lib Dems are no longer led by the Deputy Prime Minister, they no longer have the status to demand they're included. So whatever you get in the end may help reassert the two-party system.
Well, that's interesting, because you do think we will get something in the end, then?
Well, no, I think we'll get kind of what you were talking about. I think we'll get a two-hander Question Time special. So Theresa May or Jeremy Corbyn will go first, and they'll answer questions from the audience. They'll go away, and then the second person will come and answer questions from the audience. We'll almost certainly get high-profile interviews on the BBC or Channel 4 as well. But I don't think Theresa May is going to debate Corbyn one-on-one. So David Cameron tried to get out of these debates last time, but because everybody knew when the election was going to take place, there was months of pre-election time where the government's not doing anything because Parliament's pretty much just killing time until the election, where the broadcasters in the opposition could just hammer the government on this issue. But now, I mean, look, it was a big deal on the Wednesday, on the Tuesday and a Wednesday. It's really dropped down the agenda because we're now busy folk covering the actual election. So I think the broadcasters will get some sort of event that they can promote and get ratings with, but I don't think we're going to get the actual debate.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think by calling a snap election, I think Theresa May has short-circuited a lot of the pressure that would build up for proper debate.
Indeed. And on that note, let's move on to talk about some of the MPs who have found their plans for the future next 3 years short-circuited by the snap election. And the first one we're going to talk about in this MPs to Watch segment is the fourth soon-to-be editor of the London Evening Standard, George Osborne. Yeah, he didn't do well out of this snap election decision, did he?
Well, no, but I mean, the idea that he was ever going to run for re-election whilst editing a major newspaper was for the birds. I mean, I suspect what he had in mind was to go and do this for a few years and then step down in, say, 2019. And like you say, this early election sort of short-circuited those plans.
It was a weird decision to make. So George Osborne is a former Chancellor, Finance Minister of Britain, had been, you know, Cameron's heir apparent. You know, everybody assumed that he would stay on in government after Cameron resigned. Theresa May takes over, fires him, tells him to go and reconnect with his party. And despite being quite clear that Osborne does still hold political ambitions, he's basically going to try to make as much money as possible by taking over like a load of public speaking gigs. I think he's doing Kissinger Fellowship at Harvard. He's on a hedge fund's board, and that was like unseemly, and people were very happy about it. But then he decided to become the editor of London's major newspaper. Huh?
Yeah, I mean, it is.
What's a Northern MP? So it's not like he's a London MP either. His constituency is literally at the other end of London.
At the other end of the country.
Say again?
Yeah, at the other end of England.
Yeah. So it's such a crazy decision. And yes, I think you're right. I think he was planning to step down and he'd either have to look very foolish and quit his new job, or he'd have to quit an MP. And he's kind of been begrudgingly forced to do the latter. Oh well. Bye, George.
Oh well.
So moving on to somebody else who had their plans cruelly disrupted by the snap election is Douglas Carswell, who I'm a big fan of Alex Massey, the Spectator writer, and he said, no, people always say political lives end in failure, Carswell's an exception, and I really beg to differ. This is a catastrophe of a failure, the fact that he's having to step down now.
I mean, I will say this, I think the idea that this has somehow interrupted Douglas Carswell's plans is a bit much, because I don't think Douglas Carswell is the kind of guy who has plans, to be honest. Well, I think he just does things. He's the political equivalent of the Joker.
Some men just want the world to burn, but they want it to burn for libertarian reasons. Do you not understand that thirst for burning is because they believe in a small state and the technological revolution? Do you not understand that?
Well, he can go away now and he can think big thoughts.
Well, the thing I was going to say with Carswell is it's quite clear that what he planned to do was to quit UKIP. So he explained who he is. So Carswell had been a Tory backbench MP. He is much like Jeremy Corbyn can be sometimes. He's a unpopular populist. It's like he thinks he's a populist, but actually there's not really a constituency for what he's selling, because he's basically a small state libertarian Brexiteer, whereas what Vote Leave successfully tapped into was almost like your basically Trumpian George W. Bush type conservatism, which is big state, big government, and socially conservative attitudes. Carswell had defected from the Tories to join UKIP. He claims it's a great big plot. I'm highly sceptical. I think that's a post-fact rationalisation. I think the real reason was he knew they'd seen the fight for his life against UKIP in Clacton, because Clacton is the seat with the demographics that made it most likely to go to UKIP in 2015. He fell out massively with Nigel Farage, because Nigel Farage quite rightly said to Douglas Carswell, no one's buying what you're selling. I mean, Nigel Farage can tell you your ideas are unpopular. You know they're unpopular. Nigel Farage knows unpopular ideas. And so he eventually quit UKIP, literally 2 weeks ago? And clearly the idea was he's going to spend a few years helping the Tories out in local elections, rebuilding links with a local Tory party, and then ask if he could have his old job back. And the snap election has just short-circuited that thing. Tories were like, he clearly went to the Tories the day after the election. Could I stand? They said no. He could then test that big popular vote he always talks about, that independent person and following he has in Clacton. He thought, rather not. And so he quits.
I'm not sure it had that level of premeditation, to be honest. And I also think Carswell and Dan Hannan did make more of a contribution to Brexit than you think they did.
They did, by keeping quiet.
Pardon?
By keeping quiet.
No, I think between them and Gove, they gave Brexit a sort of intellectual and social legitimacy. I think it gave the excuse for a lot of mainstream Tories to vote Brexit without being tarred as closet racists and fruitcakes.
I fundamentally could not disagree more. Maybe Gove to a certain extent, but Hannan and Carswell would have seen Brexit lose 70-30. It's like, Farage had led the Leave campaign, it had lost 40-60, but Carswell Hannan's vision of Brexit is even less popular than Farage's, because because they would have gone on the going global, turning Britain into Singapore, tax haven, small state, no workers' rights. It would have been toxic. It would have been absolutely toxic. And what they did to help Brexit was keep their mouth shut and let Boris and Cummins go around talking about controlling immigration and spending more money on the NHS. There is nothing they did in terms of providing an intellectual foundation for Brexit, because the intellectual foundation of the Vote Leave campaign was a big government protectionist campaign, the very opposite of what those guys believe. And what they've tried to do since Brexit is gaslight everybody who voted for Brexit and everybody who paid attention to why people were voting for Brexit by saying, no, they were voting to deconstruct the administrative state. No, we weren't. We were voting for controls of immigration and more money for public services. And every single opinion poll and focus group shows they were the reasons.
Okay, I think this is a conversation for another time and we've got more time. But let me put it this way. On the one hand, you've got Farage and very hardline anti-immigration. On the other hand, you've got Carswell and Hannan and Go Global. And I agree with you, that's what they were arguing for. But they're almost like the yin and yang of the Leave campaign. They balance each other out. And because you've got both of those wings in balance with each other, that is what allows Cummins and Johnson to run the campaign you're describing. Because neither of those wings could overcome one another and seize control of the campaign.
Okay, well, that's kind of what I said. Their big contribution was keeping their mouth shut. Anyway, let's move on to somebody who did make a positive contribution to the Leave campaign, and that is Gisela Stuart. Oh, Gisela, every anti-German's favourite German. She's no longer going to be the MP for Edgbaston, Luke.
Well, I mean, I think there are several things at play here. First, she's been defying political gravity for a decade. That seat should have gone Tory in 2010, it should have gone Tory in 2015. I'm just not sure she was up for the fight. Also, you know, I don't think being a hardcore Brexiteer in the Labour Party can't exactly be a comfortable position right now.
No, I mean, and I think particularly fair, because I mean, as somebody who lived in Edgbaston and worked at Birmingham University, I mean, she really relied on quite a close working relationship with the Labour Students Society at the universities. And I'm sure that's gone now. I find it very difficult to believe she could have relied on the passionate support of the students that she used to get to campaign for her. And also the fact that, I mean, we've had this. I mean, people like John Woodcock have been able to do it the other way, where they say they're going to re-stand while slating Jeremy Corbyn. But, you know, she explicitly said on Wednesday that she thinks Theresa May is a better Prime Minister than Jeremy Corbyn could ever be. So it's hard to see how she could have gone through the campaign whilst pretending she wants Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister. You could easily see her being put in the Lords by the Tory Party. You could easily see her end up being a minister in a Tory government if she was so inclined. I really like Gisela. I've always liked Gisela. I remember listening to her talk when she was a Labour Party's representative in the European Union's Constitutional Convention, and she's quite shrewd, but she is remarkably right wing for a modern day Labour MP. And It, particularly when you think that the likes of Frank Field may be in trouble in Liverpool, this might be a passing of an era. We might be seeing the end of the socially conservative strand of the Labour Party.
Well, actually, can you just go into that for a second? Because I hadn't heard that about Frank Field.
Well, I mean, I don't know much details. I can dig into it more, but there's certainly evidence in some areas of Liverpool, Labour's ruined, put it that way. I think Frank Field will probably be fine, but you think about people like John Woodcock, who are in trouble as well. It certainly looks like some of these areas where Labour's always put forward quite socially conservative candidates might be replaced with actual Conservatives as you get this Tory revival in Northern England.
Well, I mean, John Woodcock in Barrow, I can see. I think it would be almost unbelievable for the Tories to win a seat in Liverpool. Certainly Birkenhead. I can't begin to imagine how that would happen.
There are definitely concerns about the Wirral seats.
The Wirral, we can get into the sophology of this a bit later on in the campaign, but the Wirral seats are very different from Birkenhead.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Moving away from Brexiteers to their apotheosis, the arch anti-Brexiteer, a man whose heart, if you were to cut him, his blood would be blue and yellow. It is the one, the only, Ken Clark.
Mr. Ken Clark. I mean, he had to stand, really, because he takes some kind of perverse pride in the idea that his political career will exactly bookend Britain's membership of the European Union, or the EEC as was. I also can't imagine him not being there for the Brexit debate. And let's face it, it's not like he's going to face a very arduous campaign in Rushcliffe. That's a seat where the Tory vote is weighed, not counted. I'm glad he's going to be in the House of Commons, because he does give the place a bit of colour. And it's always nice to have that kind of throwback to an earlier age.
Well, Ken Clark is a fascinating person, because he is exactly what politics lacks now, but it's not what people think it is. So you get a lot of people talk about how politicians are not as independent as they used to be, that they're all robots who take orders from central command. And it's not true. I can prove it with graphs. You know, it's like politicians are more likely to rebel now than at any point in recent British political history. The idea that politicians are servile in face of the whips just isn't true. It's not true. They work harder, they think more independently, they're more willing to face down the party bosses, but they're boring. They're really, really boring. It's a lot of very earnest professional people who carefully pick their words to not cause offence. So they may do quite bold things, but they won't say interesting things. Ken Clark is the opposite. Ken Clark, I know, he'd been in politics for about 30 years before he cast his first vote against the party whip. Now, the guy literally was a whip for 2 years after he joined Parliament and didn't leave the front bench until 1997. This guy was a party line machine politician, but he has a nice turn of phrase. He wears hush puppies. He looks colourful. And so people think he's a maverick. He's not. Until he basically went into semi-retirement.
Now, this is important. Ken Clark has denied that he's ever worn hush puppies.
Yes, I have heard this. They're suede, aren't they? They're not hush puppies, they're suede.
They're very expensive suede.
Keep it on the Remainer theme. We have Nick Clegg, who, like Ken Clark, had thought of standing down, but he's not going to stand down from Sheffield Hallam seat. Our listener, not the only listener, but one of the few to talk to us, our listener Miles asked whether we thought he would hold on to his seat. And my answer would be, hell yes, it's going to be a massacre, because the Lib Dem vote was artificially deflated last time by their unpopularity due to coalition. The type of highly educated, affluent, liberal-leaning constituency that Sheffield Hallam is a type of constituency where the Tories within there are probably going to stampede away from the Brexit party the Conservatives have become.
And I think there's another issue there, which is Labour are going to have bigger fish to fry, both nationally and regionally. And Oliver Coppard, who was the candidate in 2015, had enormous support from the Labour Party organisation. They're simply not going to be able to afford to do that this time. So I agree with you. I think Nick Clegg will hold this seat relatively easily. The one thing I will say is I'm going to be interested in how much Nick Clegg is used in the broader Lib Dem campaign. Do they now think he's a popular enough figure among Remain voters to blot out, you know, the coalition and his record, both real and imagined, as Deputy Prime Minister?
You know, it's an interesting argument, actually. I don't think there's been enough research done on who is popular amongst Remain voters. My guess is probably no, he isn't an asset, but who else the Lib Dems have? I mean, they still have to bring out Paddy Ashton. Paddy Ashton retired from public life almost 20 years ago. But in any case, I'd imagine you'll stay in his seat quite a bit, because he'd be quite keen to not lose his seat. Maybe in some of the Tory-held Lib Dem marginals, he might be used in the sense of, hey, I'm Nick. Yes, I know you're scared about the idea of the Lib Dems letting Jeremy Corbyn in, but come on, guys. Don't you remember why I did Gordon Brown? I can do. If you vote for X in this constituency, we can do it to Jeremy Corbyn too. Which brings us on to Vince Cable. Sir Vince Cable, who has announced he's going to re-stand for Twickenham. And again, Luke, not to keep the theme of boring Lib Dem seats, this is going to be an absolute massacre. I can't remember the MP's name, but I hope the Tory that beat him 2 years ago has got her CV ready, because she's going to need it.
I disagree with you there. I think Vince Cable will win the seat, but I think it will be far closer than you think it will be. Tanya Matthias is the name of the Conservative MP at the moment. And if you read Conservative Home or a number of other Conservative-leaning blogs in 2015, she was mentioned again and again as one of the best campaigning candidates the Conservative Party's got. She will shake the hand of every single voter in that constituency twice. She's a force of nature. Also, you know, traditionally voters tend to take a relative view of ex-MPs coming back to stand in the same seat. Now, I think that will be outweighed by the fact that Twickenham voted very heavily to Remain and its relatively narrow Tory majority. But I wouldn't be shocked if Vince Cable didn't win. I'd be surprised. I wouldn't be shocked.
I would be shocked. I mean, this, if they can't pick up Twickenham, they're not going to get more than 15 seats. I mean, I'd almost go as far as saying, if they can't pick up Twickenham, they're not going to get 10 seats.
I mean, I think Twickenham will be the constituency where the idea that the individual candidate makes a difference will get tested to destruction.
I, you know me, I don't really believe the individual candidate makes much of a difference, which is why I refuse to learn who their names are. To me, if you look at Twickenham, it is the seat, it's the second narrowest majority the Tories have over the Lib Dems. And it has a massive... No, all the estimates show it went to Remain by something like 70%. So, if the Lib Dem surge happens, the Lib Dem should win this easily. If they can't win Twickenham, there's no reason to think they can win any seat other than... is it Ives? St. Ives. Because it will just show that deep down the Tories are sticking with the Tory party, even if they were the type of Tory that voted Remain. So I think he'll get back in, and that'll be a really big deal, because the Lib Dems would be a far more effective force if Cable had managed to hang on, because he'd almost said he became leader, and he'd given them a lot more credibility when it came to getting broadcast interview slots. Moving on to Labour, we have the sad news that everyone's favourite next Prime Minister, Alan Johnson, is going to spend more time with his missing sense of ambition. Alan Johnson repeatedly was the forefront of Labour moderates' hopes and dreams to get rid of the awful Gordon Brown, the awful Ed Miliband, the awful Jeremy Corbyn. And each time he went to him and said, yeah, I don't really want to be Prime Minister. And they were like, no, you do, you just don't know yet. And thankfully, finally, the charade can end and we can all go on with the rest of our lives.
What's going to be really interesting there is that's an example of a safe Labour seat that is going to need a new candidate in it. So there's going to be a fascinating selection process there. I mean, I think a lot of the reason why you've got a lot of veteran Labour MPs re-standing, people like, I think the best example would be Harriet Harman in Camberwell and Peckham, is that they don't want to leave their safe seat to a Corbynista.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, Stephen Bush had a very good explainer on the New Statesman's podcast about how because it's a snap election, the normal selection process has been upended. The Labour NEC, National Executive Committee, gave itself the power to confirm all current MPs in their posts and also all former candidates as well. And that if there was a seat that the current MP or former candidate did not want to re-stand, the NEC's officers, which is basically Corbyn Watson and a bunch of union bots, get to pick who will be the candidate. So, the hot rumour for Alan Johnson's seats in Hull is David Prescott's very interested. It's known that Kate Murray, who is in the Corbyn's leadership team. Katie Murphy, is one of his advisors, is very close to Len McCluskey. She's probably going to get a seat somewhere. Because what you got is not just Alan Johnson's seat, you also got people like Andy Burnham, Steve Rotherham, who are expected to win the city region mayoralties, who will also stand down in advance of being elected in May. So there will be some safe seats that the unions will be fighting out amongst each other. But yeah, it does look like we're not going to get too much of a Corbynite resurgence. Unless you get a situation where Labour wins seats, a very unlikely occurrence, because what it does seem like is, well, the MPs aren't standing down in great numbers. Defeated candidates are, because why take 5 weeks unpaid leave from the job to lose again? And that's where the Corbynistas might get in. Which brings us on to Strictly Come Dancing's Ed Balls, who lost his seat in the last election quite narrowly. Maybe would have been able to win it if he'd gone back to his constituency and campaigned it heavily in the final few weeks. Had been talked of him potentially re-standing, using his fame from taking part in as any Americans listening, we are not joking, a ballroom dancing competition.
You're really up there with popular culture, Will. It's called Dancing with the Stars in the US.
Yes, but name your former politicians that take it. Oh,
Dan Quayle.
So who did?
Dan Quayle.
Dan Quayle took part in it.
Yeah.
We completely missed that. I know Chris Jericho, the WWE wrestler, did. I didn't know Dan Quayle had. So there were four Ed Balls may use that popularity to re-enter Parliament, and he's not doing that. And I think the reason he's not doing that is because there's a good chance his wife may stand for Labour leader if Corbyn goes after this general election. And it was always slightly awkward, the idea of a wife leading a political party when her husband was a senior member of that parliamentary party. And this, I think, removes that awkwardness.
I mean, I think it's much more straightforward than that. I just think Ed Balls has moved on with his life. Also, frankly, I think he'd be in a very uphill fight to win Morley and Outwood this time round. So, frankly, I think there's more chance of Dan Quayle standing for that seat than Ed Balls. So
it's one of those seats where the collapse of the UKIP vote is going to hurt Labour, because what's going to happen is you're going to get a lot of people who voted UKIP in 2015 who go back to the Tories.
Well, without getting into the weeds on this, this has been a seat that's been experiencing gentrification for quite some time. And in 2015, the boundary was moved slightly to make it a much more Tory-leaning seat anyhow.
Well, it's not just that, but in 2010, he got word from his agent, get your ass back here, we need you on the doorstep campaigning, and that's how he got a majority of just over 1,000. So it was an uber marginal seat going into 2015, and what he's annoyed by was he didn't get the same warning. Now he thinks that the central Labour team was either incompetent or deliberately shielding him from this information because they wanted him to focus on the national campaign. So I think it's the right decision for him, it's the right decision for Rebecca Cooper, and yeah, it's the type of seat you really can't see Labour regain. I mean, maybe that's your homework as you're the cephalologist amongst us. You know, you go away and find the seats Labour could plausibly gain that aren't in Scotland. Because there are ones in Scotland they could gain on the basis of tactical voting with other unionist parties, but I struggle to see one in England.
Okay, I challenge accepted.
Challenge accepted. And on that note, we are going to say adieu. But before we go, Luke is going to take us out. He's going to play us out with some thoughts on Len McCluskey's triumphant victory in the Unite Trade Union General Secretary election.
Well, maybe not. Maybe not, because Sky are reporting that Gerard Coyne might challenge the decision in court.
I hadn't heard this.
It's just popped up on Twitter.
So, to give people some background, Unite is one of our biggest trade unions, probably not the biggest, probably the second biggest. Certainly one of the big three, along with Unison and GMB.
Yeah, if we've got any American listeners, think of the Teamsters.
Yeah, but broader than that, because our unions are bigger, cover more areas than American unions. And Len McCluskey is a general secretary, so like the boss of the union. And he was approaching the maximum retirement age. So he would not be able to stand for election if he served out his full term. So he called a snap election. He resigned to stand before he hit the maximum retirement age. And this was meant to be fairly easy, because although Len McCluskey gets a lot of trouble in the press for being too left-wing and for being too close to Jeremy Corbyn, he's actually quite a good general secretary. Unite is very well run. He's led the union to some quite successful pay renegotiations, in particular in Jaguar. Even though he's been close to Jeremy Corbyn, he has actually stood the union's ground, both with Corbyn but also with Scottish activists, when it comes to protecting the nuclear deterrent, because Unite members actually work on building the submarines. So thought was he was going to win easily. He was challenged by a left winger and a right winger, who was Neil Coyne, and Neil Coyne actually ran in pretty close.
Yes.
But he ran them pretty close, didn't he? It was like 6,000 votes.
Yeah, and apparently, as I say, I don't know any details, but it's just come up on Twitter that Gerard Coyne is considering challenging that result in the courts.
Well, Coyne has been suspended from his job in Unite as a regional director for the West Midlands. So there certainly seems to be very odd things going on in Unite, and this story will run and run. And the key thing about this story is that Unite So the way it works in the in Britain is that the Labour Party, the unions have a formal role within the Labour Party's internal democracy. It's not like the Democrats where they just give money and give activists. We actually get to have ex officio seats on the party's National Executive Committee. They cast votes at the party's conference. No, they're a big deal. And there are three big unions within the Labour Party, which are Unison, Unite and GMB. Unite have been the most pro-Corbyn of the three unions, GMB the most sceptical of the three. And if McCluskey had have lost, that would have probably been curtains for Corbyn as leader in fairly short order, because you'd no longer have had the backing of any of the major unions. So it's going to be an interesting story, and it's obviously not helpful for Unite to have to deal with this whilst they're trying to get back onto an election war footing.
No.
Okay. We've talked about the trade unions. We've talked about all our different things. I'm going to put you on the spot. One last question, Luke. Who is going to enter the second round of the French presidential election?
I think it's going to be Le Pen and Macron.
I'm going to go with Le Pen and Fillon. I don't think Macron's going to make it. I think his vote's going to slide. He's going to be softer than expected.
Well, we shall see.
We shall see. And on that note, this has been It Could Be Said. I've been Will Cooling. He's been Dr. Luke Middleup. And we will listen to you sometime again, shortly.